Please turn in your Bibles to Mark chapter 6, and we will read this morning from verse 30 to 44. Mark chapter 6 and verse 30. If you have a black pew Bible that was on the desk at the back, it's page 1015. And while you're turning there, let me just say to any students who have come in a bit late, there's a student lunch in our home this afternoon after church. You're very welcome to come and join us. You don't have to have signed up beforehand. Please just come and speak to myself afterwards, and I'll point you in the right direction. Let us hear the word of God. The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a desolate place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But Jesus answered them, "You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing, and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the fish among them all. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. Leadership. It's how the world works. Whether it's in families, schools, communities, sports teams, businesses, governments, countries, they all work by leadership. Every child in a family looks to their parents for leadership. It's what wee Molly will do as she grows up in the family with David and Sarah. She will look to them for leadership. Every school has a principal. Every community has a mayor or a chair of a local council. Every sports team has a manager. Every starting 11 or starting 15 has a captain. Every business organization has an MD or a CEO. Every country has a government. And every government has a king or a queen or a president or a prime minister. Leadership. It's how the world works. And the reason why the world works this way is because God made it to work this way. God made the human race to function through leadership. In the beginning, God made Adam to be the first leader of the human race. The Bible speaks of him as a head, a representative head for the human race. And as a representative head, his leadership determined the future of that human race. Adam's leadership led the human race down the path of sin and death and judgment. But even when God responded in grace to Adam's rebellion, he didn't abandon the idea of leadership, of headship. God's promise to Eve in Genesis 3:15 was of an offspring who would come and bruise the serpent's head. It was a promise of a leader, a fighter who would fight on behalf of her people as their representative. Noah was chosen to be the leader of a new human race in a new world. Abraham was chosen to be a leader of a new nation in a new land. Moses was chosen to be the leader of an old nation in a foreign land. Joshua was chosen to be the leader of a new Israel as they entered the old land. The judges were chosen to be leaders of Israel in a conquered land. David and Solomon were chosen to be leaders of Israel in a settled land. Do you see the theme of leadership in the history of the world, in the history of God's people? God has always had, God's people have always had a leader. At every major turning point in human history, in every major covenant that God ever made, he appointed a leader. Which means that leadership is a deeply religious thing. It is a deeply spiritual thing. It's rooted in God's creation order. It's stitched into the fabric of his salvation order. It's the way he made his world to work. And as human beings, we all look to leaders, don't we? In our families, in our sports teams, in our businesses, in our country. We all look to have a leader who will lead us. We all look for leaders worth following. And it was no different in Jesus' day. People in his day looked for leaders who would lead, leaders who were worth following. And that's what this passage this morning is all about. If you'd glance down to verse 34. When Jesus went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Now, boys and girls, I want you to imagine that you were in the boat that day with Jesus as he looked out on the crowds on the hillside. Most of the people were wearing white or pale-colored clothes. Now, think about what Jesus would have seen. He would have seen thousands of white dots moving across the green fields and hills. Now, what does that look like in the countryside? Looks like a bunch of scattered sheep, doesn't it? And that's what it would have looked like to Jesus. Thousands of sheep scattered across the hillside as he looked out from the boat. But that's not why Mark primarily gives us this description. Sheep and with shepherds was a common picture in the Old Testament, the first part of the Bible, of the relationship between Israel and its leadership. The people were the sheep and the leaders were like shepherds. When Moses is about to die, he says to the people, "Who will lead Israel so that they will not be like sheep without a shepherd?" In Ezekiel 34, the prophet lambasts Israel's leadership for being bad shepherds and scattering the sheep. In chapter 37, the prophet promises that a Davidic king would come who would shepherd Israel as one nation. In Zechariah 13, the prophet spoke about how God would one day strike the shepherd and the sheep would be scattered. So when Mark makes this statement that Jesus had compassion on these crowds because they were like sheep without a shepherd, he's not just giving an analogy of what Jesus would have seen from the boat. Thousands of people in white scattered across the hillsides, looking like scattered sheep. No, Mark is describing to us Israel's fundamental problem. They lacked leadership. He's not telling us what they looked like. He's telling us what they lacked. They lacked leadership. And that is what this passage is all about this morning. Leadership. Mark presents Jesus to us as a leader who leads well. As a leader worth following. Of course, if you've been with us these last Sunday mornings, you've seen that Jesus is a leader. He's the king. We've seen that from the beginning of the book with his royal title, Son of God. But now Mark shows us this morning what kind of king he is. And Mark does this by giving us a foil. He sets this story next to the kingly leadership of Herod. Mark has ordered his material in such a way that we first hear about King Herod. That was last week, chapter 6, verse 14 to 29. And now this week we hear about King Jesus. The two kings are set side by side so that we get the contrast. Just like you see in a political election campaign. In our recent one earlier in the year in the UK, it was all about whether people wanted David Cameron in number 10 or Ed Miliband. The two candidates were set side by side by the newspapers and the media. What kind of a leader do you want in number 10? It'll be the same with the American presidential campaign next year. It'll come down to two people. And the American people will vote on what kind of leader they want. And Mark does the same here. He sets Herod and Jesus side by side so that we see the contrast between two kinds of leadership. The fact that he wants us to make the contrast is seen from a number of links between the two passages. For a start, Herod and Jesus were, you could say, sort of like distant twin brothers. Their ancestors go all the way back to the twin brothers Esau and Jacob. Herod descended from Esau. He was an Edomite. Jesus descended from Jacob. He was an Israelite. So they were like distant twin brothers. Both kings host a banquet. King Herod in his palace for the great and the famous. King Jesus in the wilderness for ordinary folk. Herod serves his guests. John the Baptist's head on a platter. Jesus serves his guests bread and fish. The one is a cannibal king. The other is a compassionate king. Herod gives orders to an executioner like a military commander. Jesus gives orders to the crowds to sit in groups of hundreds and fifties like a military commander. And Mark wants us to contrast these two kings as he makes these connections. He wants to present Jesus to us this morning as a different kind of king compared to Herod, and therefore a king worth following. And he shows us four things about Jesus, about what kind of a king he is. Number one, he's a king who cares for his own. He's a king who cares for his own. Verse 30. The apostles returned to Jesus and told them all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a desolate place by themselves." Now, I find this an interesting response from Jesus. Notice what happens. He hears about all that his disciples have done and taught, and his first response is to get them some rest. Now remember what the disciples had been doing. They'd been on mission, making Jesus known, such that even King Herod has heard about him. But Jesus' main concern is not how much his name is trending on Twitter in Galilee. His concern is with his disciples getting some rest. He's concerned that they will last the long haul on mission with him. And so he calls them away with himself to get some rest. And Mark emphasizes the point because he repeats it twice. Come away by yourselves. And they went away by themselves with Jesus to a desolate place. And you'll notice that Jesus doesn't send them home on their own to recharge their batteries. No, he brings them away with him. It's solitude with Jesus that they need if they're going to be sustained for a lifetime of mission with him. And Jesus knows this because he had to practice it himself. Do you remember in chapter 1 of Mark's Gospel, we saw that Jesus would get up early in the morning to get away from the crowds in order to pray. He sought solitude with his Father alone, and he's teaching his disciples to do the same. What he does, they will do. It's how the relationship between teacher and disciple works. Just like we saw last week with the cost of discipleship. Being a disciple of Jesus involves having the scars of Jesus. As Amy Carmichael put it, no wound, no scar, yet as the master, so shall the servant be. And that union between master and servant, teacher and disciple, Christ and his people, does not just play out in the cost of discipleship. It plays out in the disciplines of discipleship. Jesus Christ, the master, the teacher, needed solitude with God. And so do his disciples. Being a disciple of Jesus involves spending time with Jesus alone. And I'm not just referring to quiet times on your own. I'm referring to community time as well, because it's a whole bunch of disciples in a boat with Jesus. And being on mission long-term with Jesus is only sustainable if we have solitude with Jesus. And that is where we see Jesus' caring side as a leader. Remember, he's the king. He sent out his disciples to announce to the world that he's the king and his kingdom has come. But instead of being so interested in how much he's become known, he's more interested in getting them some rest. He cares for their needs, not his own. He seeks their well-being, not his own. Herod, on the other hand, well, he took his brother's wife because he liked her. He threw a big birthday bash for himself because he wanted to. He cut off John the Baptist's head because he wanted to save face before his guests. Herod was self-seeking, self-gratifying, self-exalting. But Jesus, he's a different kind of king. He seeks the good of others first. He cares for his own. It's why he's worth following. Well, number two, Mark shows us that he is a king who has compassion on the crowds. He's a king who has compassion on the crowds, verses 33 to 34. And when many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Now, the word compassion here is rather striking. It's only ever used of Jesus in the Gospels. And it refers to a love that is deeply felt inside. This isn't a passing, sympathetic sigh. Ugh, look at all those people on the countryside. Shame. You know, such a bad situation for them. And then he just turns back and continues in the conversation with his disciples. Now, this is a deep-seated, heart-wrenching expression of love. And it's all the more striking given that the reason Jesus and his disciples have got into a boat in the first place is because they were trying to get away from the crowds. Do you remember? People were coming and going, that they had no leisure even to eat. So in a sense, Jesus and the disciples are walking straight back into the very situation that put them in the boat in the first place. Yet Jesus is willing to moor his boat right where the crowds are waiting. Why? Because he had compassion on them. And he had compassion on them because they were directionless, purposeless. They were like sheep without a shepherd. And again, remember, that is not just describing what it would have looked like on the countryside from the boat. Mark is getting at the heart of what was wrong with these people. They lacked a leader, or rather, they lacked a certain kind of leader. It's not hard to see this with the refugee crisis at the moment in Syria. I mean, what has caused that? It's the leadership of Assad, the leadership of the rebel opposition, the leadership of ISIS, have driven hundreds of thousands of people into nomadic existence, where we see streams of people walking, literally walking through Europe, trying to find a place to live, trying to find somewhere to get some food and water. At heart, what are we seeing? We're seeing sheep who don't have a shepherd. We're seeing people without a leader. We're seeing the wrong kind of leadership at work. The crisis in Syria is ultimately, among other things, a crisis of leadership. Whatever leadership you want to point the finger at, bad leaders have driven people out of their homes and their country. And that is what Mark puts his finger on here. Jesus had compassion because these people didn't have a good leader. That was their core problem. Of course, in a sense, they did have leaders. The Pharisees were their religious leaders, but they had enslaved them to a life of law-keeping righteousness. Of course, they had a leader in Herod. He was the king placed over them in that region by the Romans. But he was a terrible king, self-serving, self-absorbed, self-gratifying, self-exalting, dining with the upper echelons of society with not a moment's thought for the ordinary person in the crowd. And he was heartless. He showed no compassion with John the Baptist, who was under his care when John was caught up in this evil, conniving scheme of a bitter and revengeful woman. But Jesus had compassion on the nobodies, on the minorities, on the marginalized, because he saw them as sheep without a shepherd. He saw them as directionless, purposeless, as they walked through life. And that's why he had compassion on them. It's why he has compassion on you and I this morning. I don't think there's anyone famous here this morning. I don't think anyone here has some big population following them on Twitter. We're all just a face in the crowd. But here's the great good news. Jesus Christ loves crowds. And he loves nobodies in the crowd. That's why he's a king worth following. Well, Mark has shown us that he's a king who cares for his own. He's a king who has compassion on the crowds. And thirdly, he's a king who directs people by his word. He's a king who directs people by his word. Look at the end of verse 34. He had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. Now, isn't that striking? That's the first thing Jesus does with this large crowd. You'd think he'd first check if they've got enough water, if they've got enough food, given how far they've walked to get to him. What's the first thing he does? He teaches them. And this shows us his priority. Jesus came to announce the kingdom of God. That was his priority. He was a preacher before he was a healer, and he was a preacher before he was a healer because he wanted people to understand his healings properly. He was a teacher before he was a miracle worker, and he was a teacher before he was a miracle worker because he wanted people to understand his miracles properly. And that's what he's doing here. He's teaching because in a moment he's about to perform a miracle. But he doesn't want people to misunderstand the miracle. He doesn't want them to just see it as an act of raw power. No, he wants them to understand this miracle in the context of his kingdom. And that's what he's been teaching them. The kingdom of God has broken into this world in his coming. He teaches them that he is God's anointed king who has come to set up God's kingdom. He's teaching them that he's the leader they've been looking for. He's a leader worth following. Now you may say, well, there's nothing unique there. He's teaching them. He's directing them. Don't all leaders teach, direct? And that is true. Which brings us to the fourth point about Jesus as a king of a different kind. He cares for his own. He has compassion on the crowds. He directs people by his word. And then fourthly, he is a king who satisfies people with himself. He is a king who satisfies people with himself. Verses 35 to 44. This whole story has been building up to a miracle. Indeed, it would seem that Jesus has orchestrated it. If the crowds had to run some distance to a desert place around the Sea of Galilee to get where Jesus was, and if when they got there, he started teaching them many things, then it seems that Jesus knew all along the crowd would end up in the predicament they end up in a desert place with the sun setting and without any food. Jesus has set the whole thing up. The disciples' solution to the predicament is not unreasonable. Verse 35. And when it grew late, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." That seems sensible and reasonable, doesn't it? What is not sensible or reasonable is Jesus' response. Verse 37. "You give them something to eat." Now we're told at the end that this crowd is made up of at least 5,000 men. The other Gospels tell the same event, and they say it was 5,000 men besides women and children. In other words, this was a crowd of more than 10,000 people. And Jesus tells his disciples to give them something to eat. Well, the disciples' response in verse 37 is not saying that they have the money, but they just can't find the bakery. "We've got the money, Jesus. We're just looking for the bakery now." Verse 37, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give them something to eat?" 200 denarii? That's a year's wage, Jesus. 25,000 pounds, say, on 10,000 people in an evening, and you want us to blow it? Well, of course, Jesus is testing them, isn't he? He's orchestrating the context into which he will perform this miracle. So he asks them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And they come back and they say, 5 loaves and 2 fish. And that number reveals the severe magnitude of the problem, doesn't it? 10,000 people, already hungry given the distance they've walked and the time that has passed. And all there is to go around is 5 loaves and 2 fish. That's about enough for about 2 families. What about the other 4,998 families that need fed? And into this situation, Jesus emerges as a leader. But a leader of a different kind. We see his kingly authority when he arranges for them to sit down in groups of 150 like a military leader. But then he breaks the bread in verse 41. Says a blessing, breaks it and gives it to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish as well. And then there is the striking miracle in verse 42. "And they all ate and were satisfied." Now what does that remind you of? A large group of people in the desert, hungry, eating bread. Well, it's Moses and Israel in the wilderness for 40 years, isn't it? Jesus replicates the acts of God when he provided manna for Israel in the desert. Which means that Jesus is not just a leader like Moses, because Moses himself never provided the bread for Israel. It was God who provided the bread for Israel. And yet here is Jesus himself providing the bread. He's a king of a different kind, of another kind altogether. He is showing himself to be God. Only God can take 5 loaves and 2 fish and multiply it and satisfy a crowd of 10,000 people. And that is why he's able to perform this miracle, because no ordinary person holding 5 loaves and 2 fish in their hands can do this. But in God's hands, it can be done. Now, some people respond to a miracle like this and they say, no. There's no miracle going on here. Rather, the story reveals Jesus' selfless spirit, which inspired an outpouring of generosity from the crowd. And therein is the moral of the story. If we follow Jesus' sharing attitude, we share what we have, and there is enough for all. And so the moral lesson gets wheeled out. Share more of your food, don't eat too much, and we'll combat world hunger. Now, don't get me wrong. In the West, gluttony is no small problem. Let's be honest about that. And by all means, we in the West need to learn how to share our resources. But let's not water down this miracle. It is clearly a miracle. There were 5 loaves and 2 fish. There were 10,000 people. And at the end, verse 43, there were 12 baskets full. You say, well, Mark made it up. Well, if you're going to make up a story that you want people to believe, you don't make it that unbelievable. You say, well, he maybe exaggerated things. Maybe there were 500 loaves. Well, he's just told a story where there are 5,000 witnesses to this event. Surely one of them would say, I was there. There was 500 loaves, not 5. So why has Mark told us the story the way he's told it? Because that's the way it happened. This story breathes with authenticity. There's the numbers of loaves. There's the numbers of fish. Did you notice in verse 39, they sat down on green grass? That's an eyewitness account of this miracle. And what does it show us? That here is a king who satisfies people more than they can even imagine. The 12 corresponds to the 12 tribes of Israel. And given the allusions to Israel being like sheep without a shepherd, here is a shepherd who is satisfying his people more than enough. The mention of the green grass alludes back to Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, who makes me lie down in green pastures." Jesus is the Lord's shepherd of the Old Testament. He is God himself, and he satisfies people. He is different to a king like Herod. Herod satisfied himself and his guests with a man's head on a platter. Jesus satisfies the crowds with bread and fish in the desert. But if that is all we see this morning, that Jesus satisfies people with bread on one occasion, then we miss the real meaning of what is going on here. This miracle is a signpost. You know, boys and girls, when you're driving along the motorway with your parents on the side of the road, there's different signs. The big blue sign tells you how many miles there is to get to somewhere. The sign with a big M, which you love to see, is the McDonald's sign. And then there's the brown signs with pictures of castles and cathedrals on them. Well, Jesus' miracles are like those signs along the road. They're like the brown signs that have a picture of a castle and a cathedral on them. But does that mean that the castle or the cathedral are at the sign? Does that mean that the sign is the castle or the cathedral? No, of course not. There's a picture of the castle, a picture of the cathedral on the sign. But the sign is saying, this is just a sign. Take a left to get to the real thing. And that's what this miracle does. It's a signpost. And it says, I'm not the real thing. Get to Jesus for the real thing. Jesus fed people with bread, but it was pointing beyond the bread to a greater reality that he himself satisfies people. Jesus will say later on in another gospel, I am the bread of life. He is the one who satisfies people. That's why he's a different kind of king. That's why he's a king worth following. Now you may be here this morning as a visitor, or this is your first time in church in a while, and you may be saying, well, what does that mean? Jesus satisfies you. Jesus can satisfy me. What does that actually mean? It's intriguing, but it's slightly confusing. Well, let me end with three quotes. The first is by Bono from U2. The second is by C.S. Lewis. And the third is by Augustine. Bono, in one of his songs, said, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. You know that great U2 song? I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Bono tapped into the undercurrent of our culture. People are trying to find satisfaction, and they still haven't found it. C.S. Lewis said, if I find in myself desires which nothing in this world can satisfy, the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world. If I find in myself desires that nothing in this world can satisfy, then the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world. C.S. Lewis tapped into that sense in all of our hearts. What the book of Ecclesiastes says, God has put eternity in our hearts. He's put desires for himself in us. The problem is, we're sinners. And as sinners, we look to satisfy those desires in anyone or anything but God. Which brings me to my final quote. Augustine, in his confession, said, O God, you made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. Friends, you and I were made for God, and we will not find what we're looking for. We will not find satisfaction for our desires that are from another world until we find God. And Jesus comes to us this morning and says, I'm God. I'll direct you. I will satisfy you. Come and follow me.